From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Has Donald Trump changed the Republican Party? We'll chat with an author who answers yes. His book is titled The Republican Workers' Party. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to ban female genital mutilation in the state. You'll learn why a federal court order prompted their action. Redistricting reformers are pushing again this year to change the way North Carolina draws election maps. You'll learn details of their latest plans. And we'll examine Governor Roy Cooper's proposals for the state education budget. He wants higher teacher pay. He doesn't like opportunity scholarships. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The most excited human being in the state of North Carolina. That is how North Carolina Court of Appeals Judge Mark Davis described himself at a news conference announcing his appointment to the North Carolina Supreme Court. Governor Roy Cooper made that appointment, and the move gives Democrats a 6-1 political majority on the state's high court. Carolina Journal has followed the changes to the court. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief, and he's here to give us the lay of the land on what's happening in the judicial system and politics. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
You know, it was not too long ago that Republicans held the majority, the political majority, on the North Carolina Supreme Court. A big, big turn of events in our state. Big wins for Democrats.
Right. There have the Republican majority is gone. It was 4-3 up until the 2014 election. And since then, there have been reversals. And now, because of both losses at the ballot box and the departure of Chief Justice Mark Martin, we now have a 6-1 Democratic majority.
Tell us about Mark Davis, currently Court of Appeals judge, but just recently appointed to the North Carolina Supreme Court. What do we know about him, and why was he even in line for the appointment?
Well, he was serving on the Court of Appeals. He was Governor Beverly Perdue's lead counsel up until – right up until she left office, the last 2 years of her term, and he was appointed to take that seat on the Court of Appeals, take that vacancy right before she left. And that was a bit of a source of consternation because governors tended to do that, and the General Assembly actually considered legislation that would have changed the ability of governors to make these, in effect, recess appointments.
So he's been appointed twice then.
Well, he was appointed. Yes, that's right. He's been appointed twice. Actually, he was appointed twice to replace Beasley. In both instances, when she was elevated to the Supreme Court after she won election.
You're talking about Judge Sherry Beasley.
Chief Justice Sherry Beasley. Yeah, mm-hmm. He took her place when she was elected to serve on the Supreme Court, and then Associate Justice Beasley became Chief Justice, then he was appointed to take her place on the court as well.
We need an organizational chart here
really
for our
do.
Listeners.
Although he did win, he did have to stand for election again in 2014, and he won with about 60% of the vote. So he has been elected to this term. What we know about him is that while he is a Democrat, he got a nod of endorsement from former Justice Barbara Jackson, who lost her election race this past fall. She said that he was very qualified for the court. He was a fine judge, and so
and she's a Republican.
And she's a Republican. And she was she was perhaps the most conservative member of the bench. So
interesting.
So it was an interesting endorsement.
He will now take a seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court. You mentioned a new Chief Justice. Tell us about that.
Sherry Beasley was named to succeed Mark Martin, who retired from the court to go to Regent University Law School in Virginia to lead that law school. And she is she's the Chief Justice of the court. They've had heard the first few arguments with her as the chief. And she's responsible not only for doing things like assigning opinions, but also she is the chief, in many ways, the chief administrative officer of the court system in general. And so There are a lot of duties there that involve much more than simply hearing arguments and writing opinions. And so that's where Mark Martin, from all accounts and from all parties, excelled, was in running the court system well, getting the support of people in local prosecutors' offices, sheriffs, district attorneys, clerks of court, folks who do the day-to-day grunt work in the court system. Mark Martin got very high marks for that. So Justice Beasley has a high bar to meet.
6-1, Democrats politically in charge, even though the justice system and the courts are obviously supposed to be non-political. But we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. So the one in that 6-1 equation is Justice Paul Newby. Now, give us a sense of what's going on with him, because there had been a lot of people who thought that essentially he was the next person in waiting to be the Chief Justice.
It has been the tradition when Chief Justice retires or leaves the court, and that Chief Justice is of the same party as the governor, that the governor would appoint the senior associate justice of that same party to take over as chief, the person with the longest tenure on the court, the most seniority. Well, that didn't happen in this case. Governor Cooper chose actually the youngest member of the court in Sherry Beasley to take the seat that was held by Mark Martin previously.
Cooper, a Democrat.
Yes,
Justice
indeed.
Newby, a Republican.
That's right. And so, although this happened earlier when Jim Martin was governor and was Republican, and a Democrat left the court and he picked a Republican to take that seat. So this is not completely unprecedented, but Republicans were upset because one of the arguments they were making was that, well, you know, you should replace a Republican with a Republican. That's the way that happens in the legislature. When a member of the General Assembly leaves for whatever reason, an appointment is made by that same party to succeed until the next election. But then again, the Constitution says nothing about that. So, I mean, elections have consequences. The governor has absolute appointment powers to the courts. And so he can choose who he wants. And he decided to choose Sherry Beasley, elevate her, and then now pick Mark Davis to take that open seat.
We're making a lot of the fact that it is 6-1, six Democrats, one Republican. And that might imply to people that there is ideology and political partisanship that would be going on the state's high court. Interesting that our colleague Mitch Kokai, co-host of Carolina Journal Radio, has done a lot of analysis of the opinions, and his conclusion, just based on opinions, is that at least up to this point, we have not seen a lot of partisanship, political partisanship.
Right. Most of the opinions that the court hands down are unanimous. There are some that are split, but there have been very, very few split along party lines. And in fact, there have been some 4-3 and 5-2 splits, but the Republicans block hasn't held together, or the Democratic block hasn't held together. So there have been very, very few split straight along party lines. Part of that, I think, is that Chief Justice Martin did a very good job of maintaining consensus. I mean, the court has a lot of leeway in choosing what cases it wants to hear. And so in some cases, if you have a consensus-oriented Chief Justice, then you can make sure that the cases themselves are going to be definitive but not necessarily controversial. Or if they like what the Court of Appeals has done, they'll simply leave their opinions alone. You may see a change of this now because you do have a 6-1 Democratic majority, and what you may well see is Chief Justice Beasley and new Associate Justice Anita Earls taking the court further to the left. I mean, what you may start seeing now are opinions that are, let's say, 6-1 with all the Democrats siding together, or perhaps Justice Sam Ervin IV, who's the most conservative of the Democratic justices, siding with Paul Newby in some cases. And Mark Davis may be a bit of a wild card here.
Let's talk briefly about the campaign politics involved here with Justice Paul Newby, because people may need to be reminded that we elect members of the court here. Is he going to be running?
Yes. Paul Newby has already said he's going to run for Chief Justice, and that is an elected, separate elected position. So all three of these new people in new positions are going to have to run for election in 2020. So Justice Beasley will run against Paul Newby. Phil Berger Jr., who's on the Court of Appeals, has said that he's going to run for the newbie seat. We may see Lucy Inman, who's a Democrat on the Court of Appeals, run for that same seat. And now that the Davis seat will be up for election, Tamara Berenger, former senator on the Judiciary Committee, may well run for that seat as well. So we're going to have three contested elections next year.
And Carolina Journal, of course, following all of the moving parts. We've been talking with Rick Henderson, who is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Ever since Donald Trump won the 2016 presidential race, pundits and prognosticators have been asking, how did he do it? Well, our next guest has a theory, and it lies at the heart of his latest book. F. H. Buckley is Foundation Professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, and the book is titled The Republican Workers' Party, and listen to the subtitle, How the Trump Victory Drove Everyone Crazy and Why It Was Just What We Needed. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So I've got to delve into that subtitle first before we get to the theme of the Republican Workers' Party. How does your book tell us about the Trump victory driving everyone crazy and why it was exactly what we needed?
Well, the first part's easy. It did drive everybody crazy. Why it was needed? Well, he was addressing something that I think many people, particularly conservatives, have forgotten, which is if you have a political message, it's something you have to sell to all Americans. You can't just derive it from some abstract theories that you think were kind of written in the sky. Rather, it's got to connect with ordinary folks. And Trump did that. And he did that because he was addressing a problem that conservatives, Republicans had certainly forgotten, and that is the American dream had died. The American dream was the idea that wherever you are, wherever you come from, you're going to do okay, and more importantly, your children will have it better than you did. And that wasn't the case anymore. I mean, we stopped believing in that.
And that fit in with this whole theme of the Make America Great Again, everyone wearing the red hats.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, again is the crucial word. We used to be that country. We stopped being that country. Why? Well, I think both left and right had simply given up on it. I mean, the left had become cocooned in its own, you know, set of ideas and constituencies and didn't care about the deplorables, right? I mean, what would make us mobile again would be things like schools at work and an immigration system that helped ordinary Americans and draining the swamp. But the swamp employs so many of them, and the teachers' unions are the big contributors, and they weren't going to give up on any of that. They were going to talk about how they hated inequality and immobility, but they were vile hypocrites. I mean, they just didn't, you know, they were not going to change all those things which made us worse off, which made us, you know, which meant that we had to make ourselves great again. And as for the right, well, they were lost in a whole bunch of things. They were lost in the idea of, you know, cultural conservatism and virtue and the idea that the people who didn't get ahead were opioid sniffing degenerates, the spawn of unwed mothers and all of that. And that's wrong. I mean, you know, we didn't become degenerate. What we had was a dismal set of economic opportunities. And when he said, I'm going to be the greatest jobs president you've ever seen, that's what he was addressing. When he said, it's going to be a workers' party, that's what he meant. And so that's the title of the book.
Yeah, and I was going to turn to that next. The main title is the Republican Workers' Party, and in some of the promotional material, it said that this is the future of American presidential politics. Why
right.
so?
Well, I drafted that line. Well, because if you want to appeal to Americans in a presidential election, what you've got to do is hit the sweet spot of American politics. And what's that? That's cultural, that's social conservatism, which means you're a nationalist, which means you haven't forgotten your Judeo-Christian heritage. And you're also not an extreme right-winger when it comes to economic policies and the welfare net. So Trump, for example, said, I don't want to just repeal Obamacare. I want to repeal and replace it with something better. And then he ran into Paul Ryan, right? I mean, so people nowadays talk about divided government. We've had divided government since 2016, since Trump was elected. It's always been divided government. And the question is, can Trump bring the Republican Party along with him? Because what he has done is he's identified how to get elected. You don't just run like Ted Cruz on, I'm the most right-wing guy around, and I don't care about ordinary people. Just look at my face, right? You got to project that you care about ordinary Americans and that you're going to do something about it. I mean, Democrats are good at projecting that, but not so good at doing anything about it. Trump is actually bringing back jobs, and not just jobs, but wages. And by the way, the overtime wages are really exploding. So he's doing what he promised in terms of fixing our economy. That's what's going to make us great again.
We are chatting with F.H. Buckley. He is foundation professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University and author of the book that we're discussing. It's titled The Republican Workers' Party. You mentioned that Trump is distinguished from a Ted Cruz. He's also distinguished from the Republicans like George Bush or Mitt Romney, sort of the establishment types that people have known about for a long time. How does that help him, and how could that help the future of the Republican Party?
Well, with respect to, you're talking about two people whom I think are admirable people, nice guys who just didn't have the right message, the right ideas, and the right carry through. I mean, Bush got us involved in a bunch of wars that didn't do anything for anybody. It cost us lives and billions of dollars, and we totally repudiated that. As for Mitt Romney, the guy who distinguished between, what is it, the 47% of takers and the guys who are really producing wealth, I mean, it looked to me as if the guy who owned five homes, one of which had an elevator for his car, the guy who liked to give people a pink slip, this is not a guy who projected any great care for ordinary Americans. So that's not the way to go.
So given what we've seen from Trump and the record over the first couple of years of his administration, do you think that there is a good platform for the Republicans to build on, or the things they could take on once Trump is gone and off the scene himself? Are there things other Republicans could build on that will cause them to be successful?
Well, I hope so. I don't know who that person could be. There are a number of candidates. Tom Cotton comes to mind, somebody who figured out immigration pretty well. What you've got to do is distinguish yourself from, for example, a pure libertarian right that communicates it doesn't care about social issues and all it cares about is, how big is our GNP. These are the guys who talk about being socially liberal and economically right-wing. So their message to Democrats is, we're really on your side when it comes to same-sex marriage and the like and abortion. And don't worry about how we feel about economics because we both know we're not going to do anything, right? So as opposed to that, you need somebody who's going to connect with ordinary Americans with respect to issues like national identity and patriotism and love in America. None of the libertarians can do that.
The Trump message obviously worked for him in 2016. Does it seem like this same message is going to be one that will be a winner in 2020? Can we tell?
Well, I'm not going to make a prediction. I'm not that stupid. But I tell you, the message is going to be the same message. What's happening right now is the sort of thing we haven't seen in America since 1860. We've seen two sides so divided that they can't even talk to each other. And there's a conversation they should be having. But if all the Democrats want to do is talk about impeachment, which is, I think, where they're coming from, then there's no possibility of any kind of a meaningful compromise.
Well, on that note, we'll wrap up our conversation this time with F.H. Buckley, Foundation Professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, author of his most recent book, The Republican Workers' Party. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers want the state to ban female genital mutilation, or FGM. Republican Senator Joyce Kravick of Forsyth County explains why.
This procedure was banned at the federal level, I believe, in 1996. It was struck down recently by a federal judge and said it was unconstitutional, that only states could deal with this matter. So 28 states have stepped up and have already banned this FGM procedure. For many states have done it for women and girls. Our bill is just banning it on girls under the age of 18. I want us to join those states. We don't know how prevalent it is in our state or even in the country for that matter, but the CDC estimates that there are 500,000 women in the United States who are either have been a victim of this procedure or at risk of being a victim. And one-third of those are girls. So we want to make sure that we protect our underage girls in North Carolina. This bill bans the procedure, and the violation of the ban will be a Class C felony. And I'm not a lawyer, but I think that's 44 months minimum of prison time. There is a no defense clause in the bill, which says that you will not be able to use the defense that it is a culture or a ritual. So that will not be a legitimate defense in North Carolina. And another defense that some have tried to use is that the minor gave permission. That also will not be a defense in North Carolina against this bill. In North Carolina, we will protect our girls. We will make certain that this procedure is not allowed in this state.
Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest is backing the measure. Forrest says he's heard of no opposition.
The bill in Congress was good. Obviously, the judge said it was unconstitutional, and I think he was right on that in doing that and pushing that authority back to the states. And a number of states have stepped up to take that responsibility on themselves. And that's what we're doing here in North Carolina. It's the right thing to do.
We've had lots of feedback. My colleagues, both in the House and the Senate, are great. I've spoken with some of my women's groups at home when I became aware of this and wanted to move this forward. And as the Lieutenant Governor said, I've heard no opposition. Everyone is like, I can't believe that's not illegal already. It's child abuse when it's a young girl.
That's State Senator Joyce Kravick of Forsyth County. She's primary sponsor of a bill to ban female genital mutilation in North Carolina. At least 28 states already ban the practice. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Reformers are targeting North Carolina's election redistricting in multiple ways this year. One idea involves a proposed constitutional amendment. Republican State Representative Chuck McGrady explains.
This proposed amendment brings about three main changes to North Carolina's redistricting process by establishing a transparent method, prohibiting partisan data to be used in the map drawing process, and mandating that districts are drawn sensibly, compact, contiguous.
The idea has some bipartisan support. One co-sponsor is Democratic State Representative Robert Reeves.
The time is now. We've got an absolute opportunity as a government body, as a group of elected officials. I'm thankful for NCRR trying to get this together, trying to give us an opportunity to enshrine these thoughts in our Constitution so that we do, at this point in time, tell the people of North Carolina we're serious about reforming our government. And to me, the most important thing that we can do at this point in time is to get people to have confidence in our government again. And nothing can give our people more confidence than saying that we've got to get this into our Constitution, we've got to get these principles enshrined, and we've got to make sure that future General Assemblies follow these concepts to make sure that we get the best districts that actually show we want to represent the people. We don't want to pick the people we're going to represent.
Reeves mentioned NC4RR. That's the group North Carolinians for Redistricting Reform. One of its leaders is former UNC System President Tom Ross.
When you have a group like this that's standing together and supporting the same thing from different political parties and those that aren't even affiliated with political parties, and they agree on something, it's got to be a pretty good idea. It is a bipartisan board. We have support, however, that goes well beyond just our board. And I think that bipartisan support for anything is rare in today's world. And frankly, in my view, if we don't do something about partisan gerrymandering, the polarization that we experience today in our state and society is only going to get worse. So when I helped found NC4RR back in 2017, we decided, and I still believe, that it was important that it be bipartisan and that our approach be to find a way to have a nonpartisan redistricting process for North Carolina. The organization and the people that are here today standing up before you, as I say, are proof that we can work together despite our differences and that we can put North Carolina first, because I think all of us care about our great state and the people of this state. Simply put, we have come to the conclusion that doing nothing is not an option, that doing something is an opportunity whose time has come and whose time is now. We have the opportunity at this moment in our history to show ourselves and the rest of the country that North Carolina does not shy away from its challenges, but rather faces them head on, and that North Carolinians know how to find the way forward and do so together in these divided times. Through a constitutional amendment that outlines clear, nonpartisan standards for drawing congressional and state voting districts, we believe we can obtain lasting reform.
That's former UNC System President Tom Ross, one of the leaders of the group North Carolinians for Redistricting Reform. Ross says he's been discussing the topic in a series of meetings.
I've been going around the state, speaking about this issue, talking to people about the issue, and I've spent hours talking to Republicans, to Democrats, to independents, or people unaffiliated with parties in rural areas, in urban areas, in suburbs, all across our state. And we sat down with those people around the state and listened. The people of North Carolina feel the system is broken, that partisan redistricting is a significant part of the problem, and they want a government that works, one that works for them, that addresses their challenges, and works across the partisan divide to find solutions. Adequately addressing these issues for the citizens of North Carolina is going to require work here in this building and beyond to fix the broken redistricting process. It's worth noting that the broken system did not happen overnight. It is not a recent phenomenon. It has been going on for decades. As I talk to people around the state, I always say to them, this is the fault of the Republicans, and this is the fault of the Democrats. I was a judge for 17 years. I know guilty when I see it. They're both guilty. And it's true. It's been going on forever, and it's time for it to stop.
Another high-profile supporter of redistricting reform, conservative businessman and philanthropist Art Pope.
The effort to draw fair districts, litigation over districts, has been going on for 50 years. But I'm not going to start talking about 50 years ago. I want to talk about last night. Last night, I was fortunate enough to go to the Carolina Duke basketball game over at Cameron Indoor Stadium. And it was a hard-fought game. We had a key player who got injured early through an accident, went out to play. Referees called fouls on both teams. There was even a flagrant foul for throwing an elbow, even if it's unintentional. But when the game was over and the University of North Carolina had won, no one questioned the legitimacy of that victory. And the reason they didn't question it is the game was played by rules set way ahead of time. The rules set forth the size of the court, the height of the basket, where the basket plays. The rules set forth what was an offensive charging foul or defensive blocking foul. And the rules literally drew a line on where a basket counts as 3 points versus 2 points. And the referees fairly administered those rules. They did not change the rules during the middle of the game, or much less say, we don't like this result, the effect of these rules, so we're going to have a new overtime with zero scoreboard set back to zero and a new set of rules. Then we'll see what the outcome is. And the reason we need rules, the reason that they provide legitimacy, is that we are a nation of rules. We're a state of rules. Now, when it comes to the country and our state, our rules, the foundation of our rules, are set forth in the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of North Carolina. Now, in regard to redistricting, as I said, they've been changing at the federal level under the Voting Rights Act, equal protection theories. Now, I've been a plaintiff in some of those lawsuits. And in the North Carolina Constitution, it's fairly broad. So what this bill, though, will do is set forth clear, objective rules for future redistricting. And rather than leaving broad latitude to the legislature to determine what those rules are, rather than leaving it to the courts to create new rules or change the rules, there to be the fair administrators, this bill allows the people of North Carolina to adopt those rules through a constitutional amendment adopted by a referendum. I think this will be a great service to the state of North Carolina, to its people, for all the reasons already stated. And I think hopefully it will end the continuous series of redistricting litigation and questioning the legitimacy of the outcome of the elections.
That's conservative businessman and philanthropist Art Pope, also the founding chairman of the John Locke Foundation. He's one of the high-profile supporters of electoral redistricting reform in North Carolina. Pope joins a bipartisan group that would like to place redistricting rules in the state constitution. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Following five pay raises in a row, North Carolina's average teacher pay is just shy of $54,000 a year, climbing to 29th in the nation, according to the NEA, the National Teachers Union. But there could be more pay raises on the way if Governor Roy Cooper's budget proposal gains traction with the legislature. Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies, and he joins me now to talk about what is ahead. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
This teacher pay figure, the NEA does this this listing every year, and it looks like they say that North Carolina is climbing. They put us at 29th.
That's right, and that's an improvement over last year where we were 34th and the year before, which we were 38th. So we're seeing steady increases in our ranking on the NEA report. That's mainly due to the five consecutive pay increases that the General Assembly has approved. A significant increase in teacher salary over the last 5 or 6 years due to those pay increases is going to catapult us even further up the ranking that the NEA produces every year.
Now, that does not include the benefits that a teacher makes. We're just talking strictly salary here.
Yeah, that's really important because when you look at the benefit packages that teachers receive, which includes health care, retirement benefits, and Social Security payments made on their behalf, we're looking at around $18,000 worth of benefits. Those aren't included, and mainly the NEA rightfully points out that it's hard to compare these sorts of things. It's hard to even get data on the comparative benefits that states and school districts provide to their teachers. So they stick with the salary figure, and that's what they report here. It's also worth noting that when we look at these sorts of rankings, that they're not adjusted for cost of living. So we're just looking at what states report to the NEA their average salary to be for their teachers, not inclusive of benefits or adjusted for cost of living.
And in fact, common sense just tells you, for example, if anyone has ever moved from one state to another, a dollar in one state doesn't translate to necessarily to a dollar in another state. And that's why that cost of living adjustment is so important, to get a sense of how much your dollar buys there.
Just ask any teacher in Hawaii if they're paid
right.
enough, which has, of course, one of the highest costs of livings in the nation.
Try buying milk there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, if you adjusted their teacher pay for cost of living, they're right at the bottom. Even though it looks on the surface that they get paid a significant amount, when you look at how much it costs to live in a state like Hawaii or, you know, in other states that have significant cost of living. New York is a good example. That dollar doesn't go very far. It does in North Carolina, but not in all some of these other states.
Terry, all of this is going to receive a lot of discussion over the next few weeks as state lawmakers and Governor Cooper essentially try to put together the budget for the next fiscal year that begins in July. Now, the governor's budget proposal has a large component dedicated to education, specifically K-12 education. He wants more teacher pay raises. It seems there are a number of Republicans who would like to do the same.
Absolutely. Well, Governor Cooper has proposed a 9.1% teacher pay increase over 2 years. That would be doled out in 4.5% 1 year, 4.6% in another year. And for him, that is a large enough increase to get us to that national average as calculated by the NEA report. Republicans on their side also want a pay increase. You may recall that they promised to get the average teacher salary up to $55,000 by the year 2020. In order to do that, they have to increase teacher salaries this year. Now, increasing teacher salaries is an expensive proposition. It's $64 million to increase teacher salaries by 1 percentage point. So in order to get where we need, where the legislature wants to get the teacher salary, it's going to be a significant investment. And they're going to have to find money in what is going to be a tight budget year in order to fulfill that promise. Otherwise, there may be consequences in the 2020 election.
Terry, there's always been a lot of discussion, at least the past couple of years, from those who believe that highly experienced teachers or those with advanced formal education, that they are not being compensated like they should be. So tell us a little bit about that. And is there any research that tells us, for example, if a teacher has an advanced degree, that that translates into higher achievement for their students?
Sure. The bulk of education research tells us that the master's degree usually doesn't translate into higher student achievement. We have decades of research that confirm this, and only a few research studies out of the hundreds done have ever said that having a master's degree, specifically a master's degree in education, translates into higher student achievement. And so based on that fact, the General Assembly 5 years ago decided to eliminate the amount of money given to teachers for a master's degree, the master's degree supplement for all new teachers coming into the system. All those that had a master's degree up to that point were grandfathered in, as well as teachers who needed a master's degree for their job were also included in that pay supplement. There's a strong movement right now to raise the teacher salary supplement to include all teachers that have a master's degree, or an alternative plan to just give a master's degree supplement to those who have a master's degree in the subject area. So if you're a math teacher, you have a master's degree in math, you would get the supplement. The research is a bit mixed on that. It would be a much better investment, frankly, if we had more teachers go into national board certification or some other way of getting a supplement for advanced training rather than a master's degree. But it looks like there's bipartisan effort to get the master's degree pay restored. Governor Cooper certainly wants it, as well as some Republicans in the House.
Terry, let's talk more about a key component of the governor's budget budget proposal, which is receiving a lot of pushback, including from you and the John Locke Foundation, because this involves a closing of the door that the governor wants to see on the Opportunity Scholarship Program. And that is a scholarship program for low-income families, for parents to be able to take their child, if they qualify for the program, take a voucher and put their child into a private school that they think will be better for their child. The governor does not want this to continue.
Frankly, it's both predictable and appalling that he would do this to low-income families that simply want something better for their children. The Opportunity Scholarship Program provides $4,200 a year scholarships to very low-income families. The average income of the Opportunity Scholarship families is around $17,000 a year. And so what he does is he says anyone that's in the Opportunity Scholarship Program right now can stay in. Nobody else gets to have access to these scholarships, even though there's tremendous demand for them. And furthermore, if you drop out of the Opportunity Scholarship Program, that doesn't free up a slot. That just means that that's one less scholarship that's available. Honestly, it's a slap in the face to these low-income families that are simply seeking a private school education for their children for any number of reasons. It could be academic concerns. It could be the safety of their children, which is a pretty prominent reason why people are choosing Opportunity Scholarship, because they fear for the safety of their child, or any number of other reasons that they have cited in surveys and research. Honestly, Governor Cooper should be ashamed of himself for making this move. And honestly, I think that in the end, we won't see any sort of shutting the door on this program because legislative Republicans won't stand for it.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.